All right, so we're at GoTo 2012. We have JavaScript virtual machine implementers sitting in front of us. Lars Bach from VA, Steve Luco from Chakra, which is the engine inside of IE. So thank you for coming on Channel 9. What I want to ask you to talk about today a little bit was the strategies that you've taken to eke as much performance as you possibly can in your engines. Both of them are very fast. So can we kind of go, like, maybe start with Lars and.
First of all, as you say, I'm not working on V8 anymore, but I was
Understood.
one of the original engineers on the project. And one thing that's interesting with V8 is that we're pretty much the first high-performance JavaScript engine that was made for JavaScript. And so we basically had no clue how we would make it fast when starting out. So we had to do some predictions. One thing I knew when doing VMs is that having a good compiler is not enough, and especially when you have a very dynamic system like JavaScript. So we decided early on that we needed to solve a few issues or solve a few problems. The first one is that we needed a way of making sure that similar objects in JavaScript would be handled by the same code. That's one thing. The other one, we wanted to make sure that we could execute object-oriented programs really well, so it needed a real good automatic memory management system. And then, of course, we also needed a compiler. So that was sort of a starting point.
Okay.
Maybe that's good enough for now.
Great. So, well, first of all, I'd like to thank Lars for being the pioneer in bringing really high performance to JavaScript, and the V8 engine was really the one that made the quantum leap there. And since then, we've been tracking it down, and we've had a pretty good competition, and where we've gotten to the point where we can do pretty well with everything. And so some of the early things that really surprised me was the structure of web pages, just how much code there was. And in some cases, how little of the code that came down from web pages actually ran. And so we tried to take an experimental approach from the beginning and do a lot of measurement to say not just, okay, what is this language and how can we write a good virtual machine for it, but to actually measure what was going on, measure things like Outlook Web Access or Gmail, measure Bing Maps, Google Maps, and a bunch of the top 300 websites, like New York Times. We did a massive study of that. So, because we wanted to see what people were really doing and what design patterns people actually used. And we found, for example, that one of the big cable news sites downloads 70,000 functions and only calls 19% of them during page load. And so, also, we found for other web pages that every JavaScript framework that you could think of, jQuery, Prototype, Dojo, just on down that list, all present in the downloaded code and multiple times often. So maybe four versions of jQuery. We found situations like that.
Wow.
And so you have to, like Lars was saying, you can't really predict until you get in the situation and you start measuring what's out there and what people are doing. So the first thing is to measure, and then you come up with strategies.
That's true. Doing measurements are good. But that's one thing I want to add is that what you find out there on the web when you measure it is just a reflection of how well the existing system does. So when you started out, as an example, before you got into the game at Microsoft doing JavaScript engines, I know the previous one did a full garbage collection per each 1,000 allocated objects. So that prevented people from, when they deployed web apps, to actually do any allocation, really. And then you get sort of the application are sort of limited what they can do. And if you measure that and use that as the only pointer to where you're going, that's not enough. So we certainly, when we started the V8 engine, we also wanted to make sure we looked a little bit ahead, so that when you got the performance with a better engine, then you get a different class of application. And I think that is obvious that the way people write web apps today has changed a lot over the last 5 years.
That is true. So I would totally agree that you do have to plan for the future. So you do have to provision a lot more power than just for the things you've measured and you see. And we tried to do that. And also, we have observed the same as Lars, that even over the last 2 years, as the Chakra engine has matured and gotten faster and been available, so that web developers can now assume that there's a modern browser from every vendor that is fast, the code has changed a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot more of it, for example, per web page. So there's a pretty interesting dynamic going on between what web developers are doing and then what the available power of the script engines are. So you have to pay attention to how things evolve, and you have to, like Lars mentioned, you have to plan. So one thing we did to plan for that is we put in a lot of features into the garbage collector that help with that. One of the big features we did was to make the garbage collector concurrent, which means that most of the work of collecting the old objects that you no longer need is done in another core, so that while you're busy playing a game or interacting with your Gmail, there's another core off collecting the garbage and bringing it back and recycling it. So,
nice.
So that's an example of where we planned. We didn't need to do that for the initial set of things that we saw, but that has come in handy as people have built more and more complex applications that allocate more objects.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at you can play games on the web now at near native speeds, so it feels, but it certainly isn't. If you look at Atari site that was recently announced that has a bunch of old Atari games that run really, really fast. Part of that is the graphical rendering, though, which doesn't have anything to do with the JavaScript, which is CPU bound. So the stuff in IE9 and in the Chrome as well and other browsers where you're basically rendering all of the CSS and graphics and stuff on the GPU has
yep.
really helped as well for performance.
Well, games is a great example. That's more of a frontier for us because it's something that is coming more and more. We're seeing more and more use of HTML5 for games. One of the challenges with games is predictable performance because of the way JavaScript is, that with very little type information or other types of guardrails, what you have to do to get great performance with it is you have to make guesses. You have to see what is going on in the code and then guess. Like, well, the last 50 times that this loop had this variable, it was a double. So let's make it a double, and then we'll just put a little check at the top to make sure we don't have to go back and jump into the interpreter to figure out what else to do. So when you have heuristics, when you have, which is the fancy word of computer science for guesses, then you have unpredictability. You have waves up and down. So we might start running something in the interpreter, which is fairly slow, figure out what code needs to be generated, generate it, and then that initial guess might be only partially right, and we may have to regenerate code. Each one of those phases of execution is going to have a different performance. Now, for interactive response, usually there's enough tolerances built in so that that's not going to affect something like, did I see immediate response when I click? But for a game where you have 16.7 milliseconds per frame, if you do something and it takes, 20 milliseconds instead of 10 milliseconds before you have figured out the best code to generate, too bad, you dropped a frame. Okay?
And another thing is also that when you do games in HTML5, right, it has to work on all browsers. And different browsers have different performance characteristics. So if you have these tight constraints between frames, it's very hard to ensure that it works well on all systems. In addition to what you talked about with the heuristics in the code generator, we actually do something more funky. That is that if a type is not as you expect, right, you would revert to a slower executing version of the code by doing de-optimizing the optimized stuff, and then try to optimize again. As you can imagine, over the lifetime of a game, you will compile, de-optimize, recompile again as you go along. And that, no matter how you do it, background or not, you still have to deal with these uncommon cases in the code.
And what Lars and I are learning, you know, over the course of, well, Lars has been at it since 2006, and our team has been at it since late 2008. What we're learning is that's inherent. So you can either run JavaScript predictably and sort of medium performance, or you can take these risks and say, well, I think the type is this, or I think it's going to work this way. So if you want excellent performance starting to approach native performance, you have to do these guesses, these heuristics. But then it leads to what Lars was saying, that then you might have to back off, and you might have sort of waves in performance. So that's some of the inherent challenge of JavaScript.
But I also have to say that when you do these optimistic optimizations, that's also where you'll get the high performance. And we're talking about a factor of tens in certain
That's right.
cases. For instance, if your program deals with numbers, a lot of number computation, then we can recognize these numbers, and we will sort of unbox the doubles on the activation stack. But if it fails, right, we have to peel it off again and reconstruct the canonical form and continue. So we try to do these heuristics to get maximum performance, but it has this unpredictability part of it. One thing I'd like to add is that the reason why we work so hard on getting performance in JavaScript is there's a friendly competition in the marketplace. All the browser vendors have now much faster JavaScript engines, and the tech writers, they run benchmarks whenever there's a new release of a version, and they'll publish it. So I think actually it's great for the users, because it means today compared to 5 years ago, JavaScript runs 100 times faster on the same hardware. And that's fantastic, and it'll benefit everybody.
And if you think about that factor of 100, and then think about Moore's law. So, you know, one of the things that we've known for a long time is this idea that performance is going to double about it every 18 months. So if you take that factor of 100, let's just round it to 128, so that's 7 doublings, okay? So if you do 7 times 18 months, so that's almost a decade worth of Moore's law that has happened in much less than a decade, more like about 4 years since this competition's been going on. So what does that do? So what did Moore's law do? It made people write much more code and be much more ambitious about what software could do. And that's what's happening with the web development model now, is that with the browser vendors competing to make JavaScript super fast, it just enables more and more classes of applications to run. That's why we have been working on this TypeScript thing, because that you may have heard about.
Yeah.
Because we're recognizing that teams are going to write more and more code, just as when chips got faster and faster, we got much more ambitious with our software. So it's a great thing, and the V8 team deserves a lot of credit for kicking off that competition.
Absolutely.
Because it's made web development much richer.
So the question that I'd like to ask now, I mean, it's sort of, how far are you going to go? How fast can JavaScript get?
Good question.
It's very hard to come up with a number. So we can certainly, so give me a benchmark and tell me how fast you want it to run, and I'll do it. The interesting part about JavaScript performance, because JavaScript is so dynamic, whenever you design a JavaScript engine, you want to make it fast. You are designing the system to run fast only for a certain part of the programming language or a certain behavior. And if you fall out of that small sweet spot, if you will, then the performance goes down. So I think it's a balance when you improve performance and widen the sweet spot, at the same time also make it faster. So there's certainly improvements to be had in JavaScript. I guess if you work really hard at it, you can get a factor of 2 from today's performance.
Wow.
I still want to say that right now JavaScript is not the performance bottleneck in browsers when you run normal web applications.
No.
It's using a fraction of the time. Mm-hmm. So right now it's mostly an enabler. It allows the application programmers to do more logic and put it in the browser, which is great. And that will happen over time. So performance will always be a key issue. One thing I just want to add from the previous discussion is that it all sounds so great, we made it so many times faster, but this kind of technology we have been doing is actually, we're standing on the shoulders of other projects.
Sure.
A lot of this technology was developed at Sun Labs in the Self Group, where a dynamic compilation, a collection of polymorphic inline caches and de-optimization and cool stuff like that. And a lot of these technologies are what we are using today in these JavaScript engines.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that, and I would add a shout out to Craig Chambers with the CECL project.
Yeah.
And to the small talk group at Xerox PARC.
Yeah, he also worked in the Self Group, Craig.
Yeah, Craig. Dave Unger was his
yes.
advisor also, as well as yours. So
he was my manager, yes.
And then Craig went on to do a center of research in dynamic language implementation at University of Washington. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it would have taken Lars and I a lot longer than 3 or 4 years if we hadn't had all that, if ever.
Yeah. So, like the TypeScript we just heard about, I'm working on a different language now called Dart. And in addition to make it easier to make a large application, we're also trying to make it more predictable. We have a much simpler object model in Dart, and that will allow us to save memory and make fast execution. But again, it's a departure from JavaScript, whereas TypeScript, by the end of the day, you still translate down to JavaScript and run on an existing system.
So in Dart in a web page, for example, are you also doing interpreting? And I mean, so Dart's a dynamic language, right? You don't have to be statically typed, that's optional typing, so
yeah,
you're going to have to do some interpreting, right?
Unlike Microsoft, we departed from interpretation. We
departed
go
from interpretation.
Even V8, it was no bytecode. We generate native code directly from source code.
So when I run a script on a web page that the engine's never seen before, has no information, you don't do any?
No, we generate code. So what we do is we have the first level compilation generates fairly straightforward code because we have not seen the receiver types as the different points in the code. And that code is done in such a way that it captures the receiver types when it executes. And when that code is determined to be hot, it will be recompiled into a faster version. So we don't have bytecodes. Bytecodes are sort of a silly kind of thing in my mind because they can be used for different things, for interpretation, but interpreters are really slow. But they can also be used as a wire format, for instance, in .NET or in Java, where it's that's what you ship over the wire. In JavaScript, the wire format is source code. Mm-hmm. And for each function you have inside the running JavaScript program, you have to cook up the source code again, right? So that is the primary representation. So so we just decided, why not just generate native code right away, because the CPU is pretty fast.
So I know Charles wants a little bit of controversy, so I'll say that I think we made a different choice.
Sure. Yes.
And I really think
debate,
that...
Debate, not controversy.
Oh, debate. Oh, yeah. Excuse me. So I see Lars's point, and I agree that from an engineering standpoint, it's much simpler to avoid a bytecode phase, and because it's just more code, it's more complexity in the system. The reason we did it is that we wanted to load web pages as fast as possible. And there are cases where that the code generation step was showing up. So we have this test we do where we run the top 4,000 web pages by hit rate and measure things like load time. And the generating even the simple, what we call polymorphic code, which means that any object shape works for it, native code was sufficiently expensive to make load time a little slower, and we wanted people to see the web page as fast as they possibly could. So we went ahead and put the interpreter step in. I would say the other thing that we found was good about an interpreter is that the interpreter is a little bit more flexible for collecting the data that Lars was talking about. So when you generate code, you're generating low-level instructions in the machine instruction set, And if you're trying to collect data, like do profiling, it's a little bit harder to make the generated code do that than to have a thing written in C++, like our interpreter, that is collecting that data. So for those were the reasons we chose the opposite thing. I think both are good approaches.
They certainly both are super fast. So
I think in your system, there's many factors when you design an engine, right? And in your case, where you decided not to patch code on the fly, I completely agree with you. It's easier to collect the type information in an interpreter. In our case, right, because we have sandboxing around each tab, right, we allow patching of the code we generate. And if you do that, it's not actually more complicated to collect it
in
the native code. So I think it's just design choice.
Sometimes
okay.
There's different... your context mm-hmm. sometimes determines some of why you make these choices. You know, for example, we wanted to run with data execution protection on as part of Windows, which has a policy of doing that. And that has proven to really help with security for Windows over the last few Windows releases. But it means, like Lars was saying, that we can't just update the little code in place that we've already generated with information that we've gathered later, so we have to find another way.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So now the interesting thing with JavaScript, of course, is that it doesn't just run in web pages. And so it runs in different contexts, right? People are writing real client applications in it, at least in Windows.
That's right.
Windows 8 and Node.js, you have these basically web servers written in JavaScript. So you're seeing, you know, how does that impact your world, in other words?
Great question. So one thing is... those things that you just mentioned run a lot longer. So web applications or servers, they're running for a lot longer than, say, someone might stay on a page before they navigate to the next page. And so that puts more pressure on your memory management system. You have to be very good about making sure that you collect all the garbage in a timely fashion, where garbage just means objects that were used but are no longer needed by the running program. So it changes what the system trade-offs are because there's a lot more focus on making sure you're not using too much memory, for example.
Sure.
When we designed V8, we wanted to make it a sort of a separate project, and we had a clean API to it. And Node.js decided to use V8 for their system, and we didn't change that much in V8, it ran fine, and they're still super happy about it, it seems, when I talk to them. The only thing that they complained about is we could only address 2 gigabytes of memory in the heap, and we had to change that. But it's mind-boggling that you can have so much memory uses in a JavaScript program. So that shocked us, right? When we started out, right, the heaps were very small and stuff like that, so that was just not an artificial limit we had to remove. But all in all, I think the adaptive compilation system works well over time as well. So it's, of course, you have to make sure that when you have so big heaps like we talk about, you need some sort of either a concurrent collector or an incremental collector so the pauses are not proportional to the size of the heap.
Right.
Sure. And in V8, what's your garbage collector? What's your
unlike what's in Internet Explorer's Chaka VM, we have a precise garbage collector. It's a 2-generation-based collection scheme. Mm-hmm. And in old space, we do incremental collection. That again will create these small pauses. No matter if you do a concurrent one or that you do one that's incremental, you will still have to synchronize for the mutator once in a while, so it'll give it small pauses.
That's right. You have to take one of those two approaches, whereas if all you were worried about was web pages, mm-hmm. you might be able to get away with just assuming people are going to navigate pretty quickly.
So I guess one question I would ask is, I mean, it seems like everyone's chosen the garbage collector route for automatic memory management. Why not reference counting? Why not some other? I mean, that's my question.
Well,
why garbage collection?
Well, because in the 80s they found out that was crap to do reference counting.
Uh-huh. Really?
No, so
and we wouldn't
sorry,
want to implement
this is,
crap.
No, this is no. This
but
is
I think it's an
no. All right, sorry. This is. That was a joke. Reference counting can be used in certain cases, and I think it's fine. There's three things I really, really dislike about reference counting. One is that when you have a reference counting, you need to have a counter in the object. And if you have a VM that's multi-thread in some way or another, then you have to have a lock around that counter. That's expensive. Right? The other one is that you cannot have cycles. If you have cycles, the basic reference counting scam scheme does not work, and you have to have a background process that that tries to find the cycles that are not being used anymore, so you can reclaim them. I know in some systems they walk away from the automatic memory management, and they give hints to the underlying system that, oh, this is sort of a weak kind of pointer, and the system can zap it for you to avoid these kind of cycles. And the third one is that also in my mind it gets, the system doesn't scale very well in terms of size of heap. In the old days, Lisp systems had some of these reference counting schemes, and I don't find them very good. Basically, I know some systems still use it today, but in all the VMs I worked on, we've always tried to stay away from it because it has these complications I talked about.
Sure. I would just add to that that in this particular setting where you're downloading code. Reference counting won't give you the memory safety guarantee that a garbage collector will, because what you need to know is that there's something that the JavaScript code can't touch that is making sure that all accesses are going to live objects, and it's much easier to do that when you have a garbage collector and automatic memory manager sitting off to the side, ensuring that all the references are safe. Because that's kind of the way JavaScript code is sandboxed. There's no types, so there's no type safety. It's sandboxed because all of the objects are allocated by this garbage collector, and the language implementation assures that whatever property access you do goes to legitimate live objects.
Now, as hardware evolves, I mean, clearly hardware is evolving quickly. You have sort of CPUs and GPUs will be on the same die. You have, you know, machines, APUs and stuff like this. There's all this advancement going on with just a lot of power. How does that impact you in terms of how you're going to implement these things? So you're already doing multi-threading and stuff like that.
Well, that's a great question, because that kind of goes to what classes of applications will we be able to run with the web platform going forward? You know, our goal, which I think Lars would share this goal, is to make the web platform able to run any kind of application you would want to write. Because the web is great in that you can publish a program and everyone in the world can use it, and it's frictionless, it's immediate. People, regardless of where they are or what their background is, if they can just get to a web browser, they can run a word processor or learn about anything. So we want to make that better and better. And one way to do that is to make JavaScript really fast. Another way to do it is to do what you suggest and connect JavaScript to other hardware resources like the GPS that's going to be in a lot of devices, or the GPU. So for example, if we can connect, if we can find a way to address the GPU, that's got way more performance than even a C++ program does on just the CPU. And so if what you're trying to do is render a lot of triangles in a game, if there's some way of doing that through the web platform, then that's going to, again, increase the kinds of experiences you can give people, you know, 3D immersive environments and so on.
Absolutely.
So when you find a platform-independent way of doing that, you'll let me know.
Well, I think we're working on it with things like WebGL.
So hardware is getting better and better. But we can still not waste cycles when doing these engines here. And we have to think about the mobile platform as well, because even though hardware gets faster and faster, the battery is still the limiting factor on these devices. So the faster you can complete a task, the better it is for the battery life of the phone. So I think there's always a need for making it as efficient as possible.
Yes.
That's true. I mean, that's actually a great point. So both of your excellent engines run inside of currently shipping phones, and you're both CPU bound. We already talked about that. You use a fair amount of processing up front.
Yeah.
So can you talk about what you do to sort of your power management scheme and how you think about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting with phones. Like if you take like a dual core Snapdragon phone, and then you look at what power management modes the thing goes into, mm-hmm. Using two cores is not really a significant power drain because what you want to do is what we call the rush to idle. Because the thing won't go and draw less power from its battery until both CPUs are idling. And so actually, it's this strange thing because it's a mistake to actually say, okay, I'm only going to use one core because this is a resource-constrained thing. No, you want to use both cores as much as you possibly can and rush to idle. Mm-hmm. Because it's only when it's idle that it's going to drop into the lower power state. And so until you look at these systems, your guesses about what you might want to do can be quite wrong.
And I just want to add that the CPUs are extremely fast on mobile phones, but that's usually not what the problem is. The problem is memory.
Yeah.
The memory is slower on mobile platforms, mm-hmm. and if you start using a lot of it, it's going to be really slow. So usually the CPU is fast enough for most, unless you do triangle computations and stuff like that. But in for most JavaScript programs, it'll be memory bound. And so for optimizing for a mobile phone, it all is about making sure that you can get stuff into the cache of the CPU and process that instead of fetching external memory all the time.
That's what we found also, is that most of the optimizations we did for Windows Phone 7 and Windows Phone 8 were memory optimizations.
So what are some of the, you know, biggest problems you guys are working on now? I mean, I know you're invented a new language and a new virtual machine, but in terms of the JavaScript world, and I know that you're not on VA anymore, but you're still definitely tied to that. What are some of these big problems that you still have in front of you?
Certainly, doing better graphics is always an interesting one. JavaScript, I'm not doing JavaScript anymore, but I can at least talk about it, that if you look at array performance, it's still fairly pathetic. And one of the reasons is that you don't arrays are not typed. So what you put into an array, if you put numbers in there, these numbers often, at least on a 32-bit platform, has to be boxed in a separate object. So when you put a double inside an array, you have to create often an object to have it inside, right? Mm. So you can imagine the overhead if you want to do a lot of double array computations in that JavaScript. So the new VM team in Munich that works on V8, they've gone through a lot of analysis to make sure that if an array is used only with doubles, they will on the fly convert the representation of an array to have only doubles. That means you can have direct access to the element. And that makes a big difference when you do graphics. So stuff like that. But again, it adds to the unpredictable behavior because you are sort of at the mercy of the VM to decide when they optimize the underlying structure.
So in addition to numerics, so our team is also investing in things like arrays and numerics. And there's also new standards coming out called typed arrays, where programs can opt into some better semantics there to make that easier. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to work with the standards groups about making that happen. Another big thing that we've been working on is large object-oriented programs. You know, you can program in an object-oriented way in JavaScript. You use prototypes and so on. And there are classic patterns like single inheritance, for example. And so we've been working very hard on making object property access in those polymorphic cases, where polymorphic just means that for a given code site that's accessing a property, there could be more than one different object type coming through there. But those object type may have a relationship like ancestor or something like that, or even implements the same interface, which is a tougher one to pick up. And so in the work we're doing now, we're really intensely working that problem and making sure that, for example, one of our benchmarks is the TypeScript compiler. And it's a 26,000 line object-oriented program and using classic JavaScript patterns for OO programming. And so we're spending a lot of time tearing apart what's going on in the running of that compiler and also the language service that comes in the open source package to see what we can do to make it run 2, 3, 4 times faster, which would be great. It would obviously make the, in addition to the scalability work that we'll be doing in the TypeScript code base to make it super fast even on large code bases, having the underlying engine run much faster will also help with, you know, the response time of the language service.
Excellent. And of course, you know, just to make state the obvious, but both of these engines are written in C++. So you're both C++ developers in addition to JavaScript.
Well,
so, C, forgive me.
So you're not little C++.
Little bit, so you're mainly using C in your engine.
Well, actually there's templates in there, but for a long time we had to have like a meeting if you wanted to put a template in there. So we try to be somewhat disciplined.
Interesting. You know. And why is that?
Well, because templates can be used for good or evil, and we would like to mostly stick with the good.
Understood. They're a little hard to debug sometimes. Interesting. How about in your
world? We use C++, but a restricted subset of C++. It's mostly C with abstract data types, so you can see what's going on. You can change the implementation of a data type without changing all the code. So, so that's the style we've used since the Silph days, and it works. You can predict what code is being generated for the virtual machine, so that's pretty nice. It's all good stuff, and I think the interesting part is that we can all learn from each other, except that there's only one JavaScript engine that's not open source, and I don't know, do you want to comment on that?
Good one. So I think all I can probably say in the setting about that is just that I think there's a lot of cultural change and thoughtfulness mm-hmm. going on right now at Microsoft about open source, and I think there's a broad and growing awareness at Microsoft that one of the things that happens with software is that we share things mm-hmm. and we have a commons, and everybody places shared ideas in the commons and works on them together. Mm-hmm. I would say it's probably not a stretch to say that Microsoft hasn't been super good at that up to the last few years, but I think there is some movement, and so for this particular project, we'll have to see, but definitely I think there is change there. And I wanted to say one more thing about C++, which is some of our really good core Chakra developers are such as Louis Lafreniere,
yes.
Are from the C++ team.
Yeah.
And Louis worked 18 years on code generation for C++, and among the things he worked on was an exception stack, and it's been great to have those people. We have another person, Curtis Mann, who owned the PDB format and the linker for a while. So one of the good things about a virtual machine team is you get people who have kind of an infinite tolerance for the details,
sure.
and they sort of embrace them, love them, drive through them, and you know I love working with a group of people like that, and a lot of that at Microsoft comes from the C++ team. You know, it's a great team.
Absolutely, and we do a lot of work with them on Channel 9, and Louis's been on a few times back when he was on the back-end team. He also implemented the WACGS.
Yep, he sure did.
Cookie and, love that.
And that's why he ended up driving our... we have a bunch of mitigations for attacks that might try to spray malicious code into the JITted code, mm-hmm. the just-in-time generated code, and Louis spearheaded making those mitigations.
So I just want to go back. I want to just spend 1 minute in advocating open source.
Okay.
So the purpose of V8 when we started it was to make sure that people could see what we did, because then they could take the ideas or at least do better than we did. Mm-hmm. The second one is we also wanted to make sure that other projects in the community could use them. Good examples is that Node.js started to take the project and use that for their foundation. And the second one was that I guess now nearly dead, Palm WebOS, they shipped a phone based on V8 before we knew about it. So the power of open source is amazing, and to be honest, right, virtual machines, right, it's not a money making business. So I think making them open source to make sure that the whole industry gets better based on it is fantastic. That's it.
So that's why TypeScript is open source.
Yes,
exactly.
Maybe we're learning from our past.
Well, I mean, I think a really interesting thing. You know, in less than 48 hours, the Cloud9 implemented a TypeScript support in their IDE.
I was editing some TypeScript in Cloud9 just last night.
That's mm-hmm. awesome. So I mean, that's true. But I think there's also different. You know, without going into the debate of open source versus closed source, there certainly is argument on both sides, depending
sure.
upon what kind of software you're making and what your business model is.
I completely agree. For me, it's been great. And the last part I want to mention about it is it keeps your work honest. Mm. The fact that colleagues look at your code and comment on it is something that keeps you honest.
I'm sure.
Yep. You cannot do spoofing, you cannot do all kinds of other stuff because they look at the code. And I like that.
Do you ever
agree with that. I think it has been proven that thousands of eyes on a piece of code find bugs.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, people say things like, you know, all bugs are transparent if enough people are looking at them. I think maybe that's an exaggeration, but I do think helps a lot. And we're really already benefiting from that and excited about that with TypeScript. For example, there's a person who's corresponding with us who is building a TypeScript typing for Google Maps. Because Google Maps, you know, exports a big JavaScript API, and it's a lot of fun to play with. You can put the little pin drops and you know, change the color of the pin drop and stuff. And this person has already typed a good portion of the API in just a few days. So I agree, the power of open source is immense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of just tremendous developers rock. I mean, they're everywhere. It's amazing how quickly they'll take something and run with it and do things that you necessarily weren't expecting and help you push further and help your stuff evolve. I think it's an amazing story. So thanks for coming on Channel 9. It was great to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
And keep doing the great work that you do.
We will try to do our best.
Rock and roll.
All right.
Thanks.
Take care. Thanks.